The number of unhoused youth in Cuyahoga County is larger than you might expect, but helping them here is more difficult than in other parts of Ohio. Because of all the metropolitan counties, Cuyahoga stands alone in not having a youth drop-in center, a place where showers, a meal, laundry, phone chargers, the essentials of life, are found. Most cities host a 24-hour drop-in center, but in Cleveland, even the one that's finally being proposed would only operate daylight hours. And there's a push against creating even that. We'll talk to several people about why. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. The proposed center is in the works for Ohio City, but it's become the center of some heated debates among area residents. They cite safety fears. They say the operator, Lutheran Ministry, offered few details about how the center would be run. Lutheran CEO is here, as are community representatives, both for and against the project. Later in the hour, we talk again with TV host and best-selling author Brad Meltzer about his new book, which uncovers an assassination plot that could have changed the course of World War II. National and local news is first. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. Best of Tuesdays to you. On average each year, more than 500 people between the ages of 18 and 24 are experiencing homelessness in Cuyahoga County. That figure comes from some groups that work with unhoused population in our region. One resource for those youth experiencing homelessness offered in cities across the country is a drop-in center. That refers to a place where someone can stop in for basic support and amenities, a meal, to use the restroom, charge their phone, even do some laundry. A drop-in center has been in the works for Ohio City on Cleveland's west side, and it's become the center of some heated debate among residents in the area. The center, which would be operated by Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry, would be the first of its kind in the city of Cleveland. Some neighbors oppose the center, though, citing safety fears and a lack of detail about how the center would be run. Today on the program, we'll spend some time discussing that proposed drop-in center and hear from many of the viewpoints concerned with the project. And later in the hour, I'll have a conversation with best-selling author Brad Meltzer, who has two new books out. But first up, let me welcome in IdeaStream education reporter Connor Morris, who's been following the drop-in story. Connor, good to see you.
Yeah, great to be back.
Welcome in. Also joining us is Maria Foscia, the CEO of Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry. Again, that's the group planning to open the drop-in center in Ohio City. Maria, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
Good morning. To join the conversation, particularly if you are impacted one way or the other, give us a call at 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You may email us, soi@ideastream.org. You may tweet at Sound of Ideas or text us, 216-916-6478. And Connor, a lot of people maybe haven't heard the term drop-in center before. Give me a thumbnail on what it is, what services they offer, or how they operate.
Sure. So it's a place where a youth experiencing homelessness can come and hang out, get some food, laundry, showers, lots of kind of basic kind of essentials, clothing. But there's also wraparound services typically with that. So if the youth experiencing homelessness or, you know, need help with getting a job, or they have substance abuse issues or other issues, typically, while there might not necessarily be one person for each of those things at the center, sometimes there is, but often there's referrals available and there's people there that are do have training to help folks out that are living in that situation.
Okay. So, thanks. Maria, what's the need in Northeast Ohio for a resource like this?
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned it at the top, Rick, and, you know, first of all, I want to say, you know, we are the operating partner and working in partnership with A Place for Me, Sisters of Charity Foundation, the Cuyahoga County Office of Homeless Services, and the REACH Action Board of Young Adult Leaders. But the need, as you said, you know, we know that more than 500 young adults are experiencing homelessness in our community every year, and that's the number we know of. We know that there are numbers of young adults who don't even engage at all for services. The Youth Drop-In Center will address the specific needs of this transition age youth, that 16 to 24-year-old, and it put a little bit more of a face on it. We know in Cuyahoga County, the demographics of the populations are represented by 75% of young people who are Black, between 10 and 30% who identify as LGBTQ. Many youth have been involved in the child welfare system at one time or another, and there are also students, graduates, a quarter of these young people are parents. And, you know, what's unique to this particular population is they need additional support. They're at a critical developmental stage. We all, you know, kind of heard and seen research about the teen brain and teen brain development, and anyone raising a teen can surely relate to that. But the center is really meant to be, as Connor said, a resource hub with the feel of a community center where those basic needs will be met first. Often that's the priority of someone experiencing homelessness. You know, grab a sandwich, get something to drink, some clean clothes. And it's at that point where, you know, we can address somebody's basic needs, then they can just, you know, kind of catch their breath. And they can then start to think about what's next, you know, getting housing, getting to that housing stable place, and ultimately starting to help them, you know, think about achieving their hopes and dreams.
Thank you for that good foundation laid by both of you there. SOI at ideastream.org is the email. I've already got a half a dozen folks do want to weigh in on this one. Connor, this planned drop-in center, we said it potentially fills a hole here. Cleveland, the only major city in the state, and includes some minor ones there too, that doesn't have one. Why?
Yeah, so this is actually, I'd probably toss this to Maria, actually, because I'm curious about the context. But I do know that it's expensive to operate these for sure. Cleveland already does have some resources, you know, several shelters already available as well, too. So that might be part of it. But yeah, Maria, I might toss it to you real quick. Do you know why that is?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly a gap. It's been identified. You know, our partner, A Place for Me, has been working on preventing and ending youth homelessness for many years. And this gap is there. And you know, you do have other resources. We won't, you know, say that there's not other resources, but, you know, we have some shelters. We have a new transition age youth housing development, you know, going in our community. There's street outreach. But young people of this age group are resistant to shelters. They have a history of maybe being disappointed by systems. And so they haven't, you know, some of these traditional methods aren't, you know, really helpful for them. But it does, you know, certainly there's a cost to it. And I think, you know, it's a very specialized service. And that's where, you know, it has been on the radar. And we finally come to the point where young adult leaders have been working with A Place for Me, us and other partners to say, you know, this is a game changer. This would make a difference. This would have made a difference in my life if I had this type of a resource, because I just needed a hand up. I just needed that warm, welcoming environment where somebody said, you know, do you need a place to just, you know, catch your breath, like I said before, and, you know, get some resources. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is about.
Maria, we've been talking about people debating the idea of this being at this location. We never told them precisely where. This is 4100 Franklin Boulevard. Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry has owned this building for years and years. What's the history, and why did you decide that should be the spot for the drop-in center?
So, yeah, Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry and our predecessor Lutheran partners have owned this facility for a number of years. It's a part of a, you know, certainly a lot of rich history of social services, even on this street. And actually, you know, we have really leaned into and relied on the expertise of young people with lived experience that have been on this planning team again for quite some time as we've been, you know, they've been really envisioning this project. This is a residential community that feels safe. It's walkable, accessible, and progressive. And our young adults with lived experience have chosen the site as one that is accessible to youth. And people with lived experience are the experts.
Thank you. 866-578-0903. I see some of you on the phone lines already and emails. First, though, I want to talk to Lola Garcia, a resident of Ohio City, someone who has been in vocal opposition to Lutheran Ministry creating this proposed center. Lola, welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you.
We've told listeners this is much debated, but walk me through your reasons for your initial opposition to having a drop-in center on Franklin.
Well, I think the main opposition has a lot to do with what you've pointed out, which is that there are a number of drop-in centers across the state of Ohio. And what Lutheran Metropolitan Ministries wants to do with this location is absolutely unprecedented in those existing centers, which is to have a center in the middle of a zoned residential neighborhood. You know, this is entirely residential. Everything on this block is zoned 1 to 2 family homes, and that's something that's absolutely not been done before in Ohio, where there has been an effort to have those drop-in centers be in centers where, you know, basically population centers, transportation centers, and this area of Ohio City is none of those things. And because it is an unprecedented, you know, effort here, it would be even more appropriate to have done some kind of assessment on what the impact would be for the neighborhood and the immediately surrounding neighbors. And that's just something that has not been done.
Lola, is that the number one reason, or are there other reasons that some of your partners, I would say, in the opposition side have cited?
And I would say we're not partners in opposition. We're pretty much all neighbors. We're the neighbors of that 4100 block. And it is the number one reason that we just have no idea what effect this will have on our neighborhood and on a street that, as Maria pointed out, you know, has been residential, has been an area that is considered safe, walkable, et cetera, that we don't know. And there have been, I've lived on this street for 10 years. There are others on the street who have lived here much longer than I have, who have invested, you know, their life savings in their homes to be here and to have continued to get the answer that, you know, we really don't know and we haven't done the research. When talking about what effect this is going to have on our neighborhood and our street is very concerning.
Thank you.
In addition,
Connor, let me ask this. You've been talking to folks on both sides of this issue. Walkability, I would think, is one of the reasons why they wanted it there, whereas she says walkability is one of the reasons why they don't.
Sure. Well, and from what we've heard from some of the youth who are involved with planning, you know, that's one of the reasons why they like the area as it is. Have access to, you know, there's a bus stop that's not too far away. I think it's a 10-minute walk or so. There's a grocery store nearby, other amenities. They feel like the neighborhood feels safe and welcoming. And it's honestly kind of the qualities of the residential neighborhood that made it attractive to them. So that's kind of part of that.
Okay. Lola, don't go away. I want to bring you back into the conversation, but I also want to welcome now Kai Cotton, lead youth navigator at A Place For Me. It's an organization that supports unhoused youth in the area. They're also involved in the running of the proposed drop-in center, as we heard earlier. Kai, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, good morning.
Before we get to A Place For Me's involvement, talk a little bit about yourself. I understand you've experienced homelessness. You understand what this place could mean.
Yeah, I've been a navigator again with A Place For Me for about 4 years, and a big part of my role is lived experience. I'm able to resonate with the young adults that I work with a lot better and create better relationships because I have experience with homelessness and aging out of foster care.
So what's a navigator do? Talk to me about that word you used.
So a peer navigator is someone who is working with a young adult and literally understands what they're going through. Expresses empathy, not sympathy, and kind of I'm here to hold their hand when walking through resources in the community. A lot of the young adults that I work with literally don't even know that homelessness shelters exist or what resources in the community exist because they're young adults. Only thing that they've had to worry about is, you know, high school, teenage things, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it's my job to help them get exposed and walk them through access and resources in the community.
What kind of needs have you seen in the homeless community that would be addressed by this specific drop-in center?
All of them. I remember when I was first told what a drop-in center even was, and I had the opportunity to visit Star House in Columbus, just to see young adults that are struggling or experiencing homelessness where, you know, they lack just meeting their basic needs, going to go heat up a meal if they need to, sit down and read a book to their kid if they want to, talk on the phone so they can connect to jobs and other resources, take a shower, you know, just take their mind off of being in survival mode. These are the type of needs that will be met at the drop-in center. And on top of it all, we're going to be a resource hub to where, you know, they're there to figure out where their next step is, where they're going to be sleeping that night, or if they're going to shelter, if we can mediate things with their family. Mm-hmm. So they'll get all kinds of support there.
Lola Garcia, she mentioned Star Center in Columbus. Have you or any of the neighbors gone to see one of these centers to see what actually goes on there?
We haven't, although most of the neighbors that have significant opposition to this are parents with young children. So making trips to Columbus is not something that we've been able to do. But we have done a lot of research. And, you know, she mentioned Star House in Columbus. That's in a zoned manufacturing district. The surrounding properties are just about exclusively businesses. Kaleidoscope, also in Columbus, is in the downtown district. Daybreak in Dayton is in an urban business district, and Lighthouse in Cincinnati is in a manufacturing general district. So they're even seeing what happens at those locations. Sorry, I have my one-year-old son in
the
background.
Yeah, we can hear it. It's okay.
even seeing what happens in those, I think, would not necessarily be indicative of what would happen here in a residential area.
And I just wanted to ask all of you, you're opposed to the location, but not necessarily to the services?
Oh, absolutely not at all opposed to the services, and not at all opposed to those services being in Ohio City. I think most of the neighbors that live in Ohio City live here in part because of the rich tradition of social service providers that have been in this area. And, you know, Ohio City can seem very small to somebody who's not in it. But, you know, with this neighborhood, there are areas that would fit those needs better, that, you know, where you could operate a 24-hour, 24/7 operation, where you could actually be close. You mentioned 10 minutes away from the nearest bus stop, where you could hop off a bus and walk up to a storefront. And one of the things that we've offered to LMM and its partners is to be a resource for finding additional potential alternative properties in Ohio City, and work with our Community Development Corporation here to find something that would meet the needs. I mean, it's a secondary issue for the neighbors, but one of the big concerns that we do have is that this is not a location that actually can fit, that can provide the services that, you know, are acknowledged as best practices in this space. I mean, best practices are 24/7 operations. Best practices are a welcoming environment. Best practices are on multiple transportation lines. And those best practices are just not met by this location. And this location is largely driven by the fact that LMM owns the building that's been underutilized for at least the last decade that I've lived on this block. And now they have an opportunity to get a $1.5 million infusion of public and private outside funds to renovate that property that's been valued at, you know, somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000. And it's that economic concern that's really, you know, the economic concern of this multi-million dollar nonprofit corporation that I think is driving this location more than what best serves the needs of the unhoused youth and more than what serves the needs of the neighborhood.
Okay, thank you for that. Let me get some answers from that from Maria. And also, Maria, I got an email from someone on the Board of Trustees at Pilgrim United Church right next door in Tremont saying they have a facility that would fit the bill. So as you answer the questions that Lola was proposing about the dollars driving the reason for being on 4100 Franklin, are you willing to go somewhere else if that's available?
So a number of things to address there, Rick, with that. But first, you know, LMM is a mid-sized nonprofit organization. We're not a multi-million dollar, I guess you could say at 13 million, we might be multi, but we are a mid-sized nonprofit organization in the community. To the note earlier about the unprecedented zoning, first of all, zoning is a legal matter, but that the building has always been used for the provision of charitable and family and social services. It's true that, you know, in recent years, the utilization has been lower, partly due to COVID. We've had behavioral health services, mostly their benefits, assistance, some counseling. But those programs and services are really well aligned with the drop-in center that's being imagined for this community. So I did want to, you know, just make a note about that. And, you know, any human service organization, which there are many in this community and many on this street, will tell you that what's fundamental part of any engagement in social services is meeting people's basic needs. So this marries the two of those. The siting, again, you know, it came together with the young people as they were looking at criteria for the siting. And I know Kai can also speak to that because she leads that group that's, you know, was looking at siting. But, you know, the fact that, you know, the group and then us, you know, we visited Star House in Columbus. It is a 24/7 operation. That is one best practice. There are other youth drop-ins that are not 24/7. But I think the important point around best practice is that it needs to be contextualized to the unique environment. We're not in Columbus. We have this unique environment, a unique community of Ohio City and a unique street of Franklin Boulevard that has a beautiful integration of social services and neighbors and residents that are there working together hand in hand and have been there for a very long time. And again, you know, we continue to lean into those with lived experience who have chosen this site. and it's truly up to them. LMM was not involved in that process of making that choice for the site.
Okay, let's talk to a place for me. Why did you choose that site, and would you be willing to move if another place became available, Kai?
So right now, you know, like Maria said, I do lead the group of young adults that are on this core planning team. And we've been working on this drop-in center long before we even selected LMM as our operator. And, you know, what I see and hear from the neighbors is that they're really fearing the unknown. And I think that because a lot of times people who are experiencing homelessness are looked at as potential criminals because of what they lack, when in actuality, they're really vulnerable and subject to being victims of crime. And the young adults on this core development team have the lived experience. And when we did experience homelessness, one of our top needs was safety. And we all know that Ohio City is one of the safest cities in Cleveland, and our operators own this building. So it was a perfect match. And so right now, you know, speaking for myself and the young adults that have chosen this site, right now we're not really wanting to budge on this site because our operators own it, and, you know, we'll spend enough money to renovate it instead of having to rent or, you know, build something up from the ground when a lot of that money can be spent more on services that are, like, at peak need right now for the young adults that need this center here.
Thanks, Kai. Connor, have you looked into the money? There were some numbers been thrown around here. Do we know what it's going to take to operate this facility?
Yeah, it's a good question from Maria. I think it's $1.5 million for the renovation.
But is that public money?
That's actually a good question for Maria, actually.
Maria, good question.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, thank you. Yeah, the operating budget's about $1.2 million, and that is majority private dollars. Actually, we've had a number of foundations, private individuals, kind of back this project, even at some with multi-year, you know, commitments to really stand this up. There will be some, you know, public dollars. We have some initial funding from the Cuyahoga County Division of Children and Family Services to kind of stand this up as well. So, but I imagine that ongoing, this will probably be about 2/3 private funding, about 1/3 public funding, and then on the, you know, capital side, we're looking at similar mix of funds.
Thanks for that. Wanted to jump out to the telephone lines. JB, let's start with you in South Euclid. In favor or opposed? What do you think?
I'm in favor. I work over on the west side. There's an African proverb that says a child who does not feel the warmth of wood, that a child that is not embraced by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. I feel like residents don't understand that telling these kids that they're not welcome in their neighborhood isn't actually doing anything for the safety of the neighborhood. The children are going to look at them as they've been rejected. They've been told that they're not welcome. And I'm also someone who has had a little bit of experience with homelessness and being a foster care youth. And I agree that my top concern was always safety. If my needs were not met, I was more likely to do things that would get my needs met than if someone were to, you know, just reach a hand out and try to help me. When you accept these kids into your neighborhood, you're not risking anything. You're hopefully trying to build community with these kids so they can feel safe, so they can feel welcome, so they can feel like their needs are met, and so they can feel like they have a community to rely back on. At the root of this problem really is a lot of classism because, as it's been said, that location has been known for doing a lot of social services for a really long time. And so all of this fear is about a lot of stereotypes that don't necessarily have any real reason to take footing in people's minds. I mean, you haven't experienced these children. You don't know what they're looking for when they come into your neighborhood. There's a lot of cool things around that neighborhood. It's not too far from the area where the LGBT center is at. There's a lot of cool stores and, you know, restaurants up there, a lot of cool things they can get into, and it is a really safe neighborhood. So I feel like the best thing to do is to welcome them into this neighborhood. It's not going to be, from my understanding, it's not a 24/7 hour drop-in
center. It is not, right.
Yeah, the way that other ones are. So there shouldn't be any concerns about, oh, in the middle of the night, what's going to be going on. I mean, these are kids who literally are probably couch surfing or trying to find the safest corner in an abandoned building to sleep on at night. It's not the cool thing about owning a house is that you can go in the house if something bothers you, but these kids don't have that luxury. So
Yeah, no, I thank you. Thank you for the call, JB. I appreciate that. There's so many different questions that are coming up here, Connor, and both sides. You had done a lot of coverage. It mentioned Ron O'Leary, the former housing judge there. He's dropped in an email as well to say that he thinks it should be closer to people who need the services. And he says out of 34 Cleveland neighborhoods, Ohio City ranks 22nd in housing instability. He brought up a point about public transit. He's not the only one bringing up the point about public transit. I have other emails here saying it's really not as walkable as they think that we are making it sound, that it's 10-12 minute walk away. A lot of different things from a lot of people. What has been said against this that we haven't covered that you've touched on?
Sure. Well, with regard to the 24-hour versus, you know, from the morning into the early evening, as is proposed, I think that they initially had sought a 24-hour, and Councilman Kerry McCormick and some other folks said they were concerned about that, and so they dropped it down to, you know, starting in the morning into the early evening.
Kerry represents the area.
Yes, of course. And the concern was safety, so there will be a trauma-informed safety officer or security officer who will be there during the hours of operation. The one study that I looked at did suggest that the 24-hour, the reason why it's best is that sometimes folks will come, it was suggested anyway, that folks would come after hours and just be kind of loitering. And I think that's one part of the safety concerns for folks, is that suggestion that when they're not in operation, that there might be some loitering going on or waiting for it to open again.
As we start to wrap here, there is a zoning commission meeting coming up next week, Connor?
Yes, it's on the 6th, and LMM will be seeking either a variance or appealing of a decision that the use doesn't fit the current kind of zoning designation.
Lola Garcia, I heard that if it doesn't go the way that the neighbors like, you would consider litigation?
If I could just take a step back. So one of the things that has been said is early evening. Right now, the proposed hours of operation are 10 to 8. And so I would say 8 o'clock, you know, turning people out and with not necessarily having a plan for a place to go is one of the biggest concerns of the neighbors. And yes, I mean, I'm speaking not as an attorney, but as a neighbor. so I'll cabinet that way, but we have looked into, the requested change of use, and the requested zoning variances. And we don't believe that this meets the standard for a zoning variance, given the radical departure that offering a drop-in center at this location would be. And so we are very optimistic that the Board of Zoning Appeals will properly apply the legal standard in evaluating this variance, but we are prepared and considering options if they don't. But
thank you, Lola. We'll have to cut it here. I want to thank Lola Garcia, Kai Cotton, Connor Morris, and Maria Foscia, all for joining us this morning. Connor, obviously, will be covering this story next week, and we will return to this topic at some point soon. Thank you
all.
You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for being with us. Would you read a book that begins with a 60-year-old man hiding in the backseat of a dirty, nondescript sedan as it careens through narrow back streets in a Middle Eastern city, the driver's sole goal being to reach the safety of the Russian embassy? Yeah? No? Okay, let me give you some additional facts. The entire ride is subterfuge. The crouching passenger is the sitting president of the United States. So now I've got your attention. This happened in 1943, Tehran, Iran. And the reason Franklin Delano Roosevelt was hiding is that credible evidence of an assassination plot had been uncovered. And therein lies the basis for another bestseller from the pen of Brad Meltzer, this time with friend and past collaborator Josh Mensch joining in. Brad was my guest on The Sound of Ideas when he visited Cleveland back in June 2022 as part of the Cuyahoga County Public Library Speaker Series. I caught up with him again to discuss this new book called The Nazi Conspiracy. Brad, a pleasure to welcome you back.
So good to be back.
Okay, so The Nazi Conspiracy, the secret plot to kill Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. Long name, but long book. So given your history of bestsellers, people likely think you created this bizarre plot, but you've actually crafted a dramatic version of actual events as best as you could research and uncover the facts about them, based on the Germans thinking they could take out the big three, leaders of the Russian Federation, Great Britain, and the USA, all at one time. How'd you come across and then decide to research this story?
Yeah, you know, I don't believe the internet is good for many things, but it's good for obscure historical facts. And my algorithm knows me, you know, it knows that I love these kinds of stories. And years ago, it came across my feed. It was a tiny little mention. And it was like half page, maybe a page long. And I was like, a secret plot to kill Churchill, Stalin, and FDR at the height of World War II? Is this even real? Did it happen? And it was real. And I just went down the rabbit hole. And Josh mentioned I just kind of started pulling it apart. And what's amazing about the story is if you put this plot in the internet right now, I've never seen any story that has more misinformation than it does actual facts. And we thought, you know what, this is even better for us because, you know, it has names like Operation High Jump will be the first thing you see. It wasn't even named that. Like, there's just so much nonsense that's out there. And we really said we can separate the fact from the fiction and show people this true story.
Well, it was fascinating. There's a lot of information there, even for people who think they have a grasp on World War II history. But knowing about the Tehran meeting of the three men doesn't prepare readers for the intrigue, the plotting, the behind-the-scenes of the war discussion that led to this summit. Was the backstory almost too much to digest down to 350 pages, what to leave in, what to summarize, what not to mention?
Well, I think, you know, what we do with World War II is we love telling the story of, you know, America punched the Nazis in the jaw and then we saved the day for democracy and isn't the world great? And that's a beautiful story. It's a great Hollywood version, but it's not nearly as cool as the real story. To me, the real story is far better. I mean, and you almost forget it because World War II becomes this like iconography. You know, it's not just a war in America, but it's like it's the ideal of America. It's us standing up to the bad guys and doing the right thing. And when was the last time everyone in America agreed that America came in, saved the day, did the right thing, and we all agreed that it was the thing to do? So to me, you know, this moment in 1943 where Stalin, you know, just to paint the picture of where we are, wants us to invade continental Europe. He's getting decimated in the Soviet Union by the Nazis who have invaded. We've been sending weapons, you know, United States, the United Kingdom have been sending weapons. But he's like, no, you got to invade from the east. You got to do what eventually becomes the invasion of Normandy. But the only way it's going to happen is if FDR and Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin sit down face to face, look each other in the eye and make a plan. And that's what, you know, there's no Zoom back then. There's like, you guys, you got to sit together and you fly across the globe and you make the decision together. There's no emails to send. There's no, and this moment has millions of lives. It's one of the only times in world history where truly millions of lives are at stake. This meeting must take place. And FDR is the middleman because Churchill and Stalin hate each other, and he's trying to hold this whole thing together.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Roosevelt, beloved in America, friends with Churchill, according to some accounts, caught unaware by Pearl Harbor, at least publicly. It's kind of his tale that's the arc of your story, even though you deal with all three men. But your access to FDR's notes, dictation, movement, once America is in the war, it's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, you know, what caught me was, again, we all know the story of Pearl Harbor, right? It's like it's part of being American. You're raised with it. Mm-hmm. And then I read the details that just got lost. You know, when Pearl Harbor happened, FDR, we know, everyone knows that moment where he says December 7th is a date which will live in infamy, okay? But if you actually look up and watch the moment when he goes to give the speech, usually they wheel him in front of Congress or they'll carry him up there. He says, no, this is too important a moment. I need to go up there myself. So he takes his arm crutches and he slowly makes his way up to the podium. He's dragging the dead weight of his legs behind him. And if you put the video in YouTube to watch it, he never makes any hand motions because he's physically holding himself up. He accentuates all his points with head movements. It's an incredible moment and incredible character. And it was those moments that I was like, why do I not know that? Why do I just know this kind of like sanitized encyclopedia entry with this one line that's been beaten in my brain, but I don't see this man who has a Secret Service agent who's physically carrying him in his arms? His Secret Service agent is Mike Riley. And when the day after Pearl Harbor, they promote him to the head of White House Secret Service because he's one of the few guys who can physically lift FDR and carry him around. And I'm like, these are incredible stories of incredible human emotions. And we've sanitized it to just the facts, and we got to do better. And so when you have that moment when he arrives in Tehran, as you said at the start so beautifully, you know, you paint in that picture, FDR, everyone's waving to his motorcade. They're all excited to see him, but he's not in the motorcade. It's a Secret Service decoy that's in the motorcade. The real FDR, as you said, is ducked down in the back of a beat-up sedan, weaving through the side streets because they're worried there's a Nazi assassin who's about to murder him. And I just ruined chapter one of the Nazi conspiracy. Like, you ruined chapter one of the Nazi conspiracy. Like, but that chapter one, you know, Josh and I, Josh Mensch, my co-author and I, were like, we need to answer all those questions. Why is FDR hiding? Who's he hiding from? What do they think is going to happen? And we realized right there we had not the makings of a thriller, but the makings of a real life true story. This is all nonfiction. It all really happened.
Yeah, and you say that's chapter one. It's almost like the TV movies that start with a great scene and then they flash up 14 years earlier. And that's kind of the way you did it, because we don't get to Tehran for hundreds of pages.
Yeah, and listen, I can just tell you the plot of it itself, but if you don't have the context and, you know, who's moving through this, you lose so much. And listen, we all know the name FDR. We know Franklin Roosevelt. We know the name Winston Churchill. We know the name Joseph Stalin. But what I love about this book are all the people you don't know. All these people who are moving through history and one of the greatest moments in time, and they're playing just as vital roles.
Spycraft is important in this story. He was a spy, but so many other people were too. You tell us how the Americans had broken Japanese codes, but the Germans also apparently broke American and English codes. It seems the Axis knew the big three would meet in Tehran even before all the principals knew it. How could that have happened?
Yeah, you know, what's so wild is even to this day, there's no proof for when the Nazis found out that the big three were meeting. And I, you know, there's always history books that'll tell you, and I really despise when history books say this is exactly how it happened, because so many things you can't know. You can't possibly know, because you won't, you know, anyone that's there is now dead, and there's just no record. We could not find the day they find out. And obviously, you know, when we did the secret plot to kill George Washington, we could use the National Archives, we can use Mount Vernon. When we did the secret plot to kill Abraham Lincoln and the Lincoln Conspiracy, again, we have stuff from Lincoln Museum, we have the National Archives, again, the New York Historical Society, and all these in Baltimore records. But with this one, we're trying to find the secrets of Nazis and of the Soviets, NKVD, the precursor to the KGB. These are places that are known for their secrecy. Nazi records have been destroyed, of course. The Soviet records, they don't want to share them. And so what was amazing is the top secret Nazi details were kept in something called brown sheets. And they were given that name because they literally were printed on physical brown paper, dark brown paper. And the brown sheets had a special zipper they were locked in. After you read them, you're supposed to destroy them within 30 days. It was like the Mission Impossible briefcase, but for Nazis. You would think that they were all destroyed. No one has any record. But the head of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, used to always keep extensive diaries. And he very stupidly used to write down what he saw in the brown sheets in his diaries. And that's how we were able to suss out that there were people that one of the things that you could see was we've all know the story of the Enigma machine and how we cracked the Nazi codes. What I didn't realize is they had cracked ours. They had cracked secret cables that Churchill and FDR were sending to each other. And it was through there that we were able to, through other diaries, we were able to see Nazis that were on the ground, like Franz Mayer, a Nazi spy who's on the ground and who's hiding in Tehran. And then the word comes that the big three are going to join them in Tehran. And at that moment, the Nazis have the greatest thing anyone gets in a fight, an opportunity. They have a guy on the ground as the big three are coming. So you're watching all these different bit players come together. And it's just a moment where it's like the great Hitchcock quote, it's not the bang that's scary, it's the anticipation of it.
You mentioned Meyer. He was on the ground in Tehran for years. Berlin had basically forgotten he was there until he reaches out to them just when they need him most. Really a strike of fate for the Germans that made the entire assassination plot possible.
Yeah, so let's talk about him. Franz Mayer's a 20-something Nazi spy. When the Allies take over in Tehran, all the Nazis there kind of scatter. There's a few that work with him. And they think he's dead. They think, the Nazis think, oh, this guy, he's probably dead or captured, or he just, you know, went AWOL somewhere. But he wasn't. He was spending years building a network of people who are sympathetic to the Nazi cause. He eventually gets word back to Berlin and says, I have a drop zone. Send me supplies. Send me what I need. Here's a secret code to put on the radio. So when you put it on the radio, I'll know you received my message. I'll know how to get everything. And again, when the Nazis get that, that's where their opportunity comes. What messes everything up and what's so amazing, and again, those are the facts, but here's the human side of it, is Franz Mayer, this Nazi spy, is not just there because he loves the Nazi cause. He's in Tehran because he falls in love. He falls in love with a woman named Lily Sangari from a local wealthy family. And what he doesn't know is that his great, wonderful, beautiful girlfriend, Lily, is also sleeping with someone else beside him who happens to be an undercover American GI. So he's whispering his Nazi secrets to Lily. Lily's then whispering them back to us. I couldn't make this stuff up if I wanted to. And all of these things kind of, if I said to my editor, if I wrote a fictional account of this, my editor would say, this is absolutely ridiculous. The coincidence that's happening could never happen. But in real life, in this true story of the Nazi conspiracy, you just see, you know, how a relative of Lily's bumps in and gets captured, and it leads to another one getting captured. And all of this, you know, it's sex and it's love and it's Nazis. And we were just like, this is an incredible tale. And how do we not know it?
Yeah, how do we not know it is a question I kept asking myself. And also, Brad, you were talking earlier about the fact that we don't have Zoom, we don't have email, the big three couldn't talk. In this case, Meyer is arrested 2 months before the conference, but Berlin's still planning because they don't know he was caught.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, you know, he winds up being, this one guy, Franz Meyer, winds up being, I don't want to ruin this part of the book because obviously this is the fun of the reading the story. But his story and how he gets captured and the lack of information that Berlin has is what changes everything. All of it hinges on this one guy being caught. And again, I won't want to ruin how it exactly happens, but my God, all of history could be different. And again, it begs the question, why do we not know this story? And the reason we don't know this story is because FDR comes back from the conference. He says, yeah, the conference went really well. He said, and by the way, the Nazis tried to murder us. And of course, the phone starts ringing and the Secret Service is like, oh, he shouldn't have said that. And it becomes, you know, it's on the front page of every paper. It's one of the biggest stories in the country. But guess what happens soon after that? The invasion of Normandy. 150,000 men storming the beaches, 1 million more standing by in successive waves. And in that moment, this story of the Nazi conspiracy becomes a footnote to history until, you know, nerds like us say, wait a minute, this sounds like a really good story, too.
I don't want to give any more away, so I'm going to skip a lot of what I was going to ask you. But something serious here is you dip in and out of the Nazi atrocities toward the European Jews. Holocaust wasn't something the Allies knew was going on until deep into the war. You write about the shock of the first troops stumbling into the Majdanek concentration camp. Was that recorded by those troops, or where'd you get that account?
I'll tell you, when Josh and I start a book, we always—it's very titillating for me to say, "Hey, we—you know—here's the secret plot to kill FDR and Stalin and Churchill." But when Josh and I start a book, the first thing we do is we ask ourselves, "What's the book really about?" Like at its base, what at its core is it really about? And for us, Charlottesville happened, and there were actual Nazis marching through the streets here in America. We all wring our hands. We're like, how could this happen here in the United States? It's impossible. That doesn't happen here. That happens in the 40s in Germany and other places. It can't happen here. And when you see Kanye West shoot his mouth off and use his celebrity for anti-Semitic comments, again, why he? This can't, shouldn't be happening here. And we looked back, and just to back up a little bit more from the moment you asked about, we found this moment. This is what really started us on this path. This moment in World War II where there was a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden, in the heart of New York City, 20,000 people cheering with a giant banner of George Washington surrounded by swastikas. The first speaker of the rally said, if George Washington were alive today, he'd be friends with Adolf Hitler. And that happened right here in America. And instead of Kanye West, back then it was Henry Ford, it was Charles Lindbergh using their celebrity. And the reason I say this is that's what the book is about. It's about dealing with those atrocities and showing them for what they are. And the most important part is how they repeat. And there's a recipe for authoritarianism. There's a recipe for all these things. And you have this, you know, usually it takes this, you know, in this case, you have a leader in Hitler. Adolf Hitler finds this group of white native-born Germans who have all been suffering economically. He sees that they're suffering. He says, those people, pointing to the Jews, those people are the cause of your problems. And when someone says something definitively to you, you automatically assume it's true because you're like, wow, he's saying it so definitively. And he riles them all up. And those people, and that those words, those people, that's a code. It's a code that repeats throughout history. And in this case, it's the Jewish people. And sometimes it's the Black community, the gay community, the immigrant community. Pick your minority community. But those words are designed to enrage you. You know, leaders who say that want you mad. Those people are the cause of your problem. Why do they want you mad? Because angry people vote and angry people watch TV. They're good ratings. And to me, when we show the concentration camp, when we show what happens in those, you know, where they're shooting children, you know, three or four shots to kill each one of them. Children, those accounts that come through are just incredible from different soldiers, again, who are, of course, are there. And sometimes from people who, you know, were witnesses to it, like the chaplain who was witness to it. And to me, the American dream is not about just making money. The American dream is that when you see someone being picked on, when you see someone being bullied, when you see someone who's a victim, you use your voice and you stand up and you say, enough, enough. And when we put, the reason we put those scenes in the book is so you have that, you see what's at stake, and you have that need to realize that if we don't use our voices, we're just going to relive this over and over.
Thank you for that. Roosevelt, hero of the book, doesn't live much past his fourth inauguration as president, passed away before VE Day, but he died really knowing the war was going to go our way.
Yeah, the big three, of course, meet again at Yalta, and it's a very different meeting between the three of them. At this point, you know, they know each other, and beyond even the odd friendship that's developed between them, Roosevelt's obviously sick. And he doesn't even want to run for the fourth term. He doesn't want any of this stuff, but he knows at this point this is what the country needs. And what's interesting to me is we've now done a book on George Washington, we've done Abraham Lincoln, of course this one we feature FDR. And I've realized that when it comes to what makes a good president, it's not the person who makes the best speeches, it's not the person who makes the biggest promises. That's all nonsense. What makes the best president is someone who, when a disaster strikes, that they can pivot in that moment and deal with it and be the right person in the right place at the right time. And what FDR is in that moment, and this is why he knows it, is FDR has, and that's why we think Abraham Lincoln's one of the best presidents. That's why we all agree George Washington's one of the best presidents. For this moment in FDR, FDR's one of his great beliefs is in his own ability to charm. Throughout the war, he's on a charm offensive. He's like, you know what, I'm going to charm Stalin because he likes me better than he likes you, Churchill. And he charms Churchill, of course, as well. And he's the one who brings them all together. And he's absolutely right. He is the one who keeps this alliance together. And what struck me is this alliance, you know, we tell the story today that we won the war. It was not a foregone conclusion that we were going to win World War II. It's because of FDR, the alliance there is completely precarious at moments in the war, in the early part of the war. And of course, by the end, it's very different. But I do love the fact that FDR does know it's going to eventually go our way.
Your last chapter before the acknowledgments, et cetera, you address the question of, could this all be wrong? Could this have been a Russian hoax? Or is that a make them read the book question?
No, we should talk about that for a moment. I mean, you know, and I don't want to give away all the secrets of it, but you're asking the right question here. You know, one of the things we always see is these books that tell you, again, everything, they know everything to be true when they don't. They just can't. And the story of the Nazi conspiracy is extra fascinating to me because the Soviet Union intelligence officers play a huge role in saving the day here. And I won't ruin how, you'll see why in the book. But when the Cold War hits and the 1960s arrive, America doesn't want to tell the story where the Russians are the good guys. So the story about the Nazi conspiracy and this plot to kill them, the big three, actually shifts and it changes. It gets more exaggerated. Now it suddenly becomes a plot where the Russians were trying to trick us. This is all a setup. They're the bad guys. And to me, it just shows you, you know, there's moments, as we said, you know, Operation Long Jump, but, you know, all these things we were saying at the beginning. And the story shifts over time. And it just shows you that history is not math. There's not just one answer. History is a bunch of perspectives. And depending on what perspective you pick, you get a different story. And I thought it was very vital at the end of the book, and I think what readers of the book have so appreciated already and told me, is that at the end of the book, we show you all the different perspectives. We show you all the different reasons why some people say, no, I don't agree with this, and here's what I don't agree with. But you know whose view of this assassination attempt, whose view never shifted? Mike Riley, the White House head of the Secret Service. He's the one who looked those Soviet officers in the eyes. He assessed the threat. He knew the MO of the Nazis and what the British had captured Nazis doing something similar months earlier in the war. He's the one who said, the boss's life is in danger. Let's put him in a car. You know who also never doubted the plot? Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And who else? Winston Churchill. In fact, his granddaughter went and thanked one of the young men who thwarted the plot, thanked him personally, made a documentary about him. And I just think it's fascinating, though, to watch that throughout history, depending on who our enemy is at the time, the story about this plot shifts as well.
Churchill's daughter thanking him when he was like 80 years old, when he'd done this deed when he was 20. So long
it's
memories.
It's a pretty amazing moment. And also, right, he's 80 years old and comes out and again says, you know, yes, it was me who was there and I saw everything that happened in this plot. And I actually love when you see someone giving, you know, the equivalent of what is arguably a deathbed confession, right? People at the end of their lives, they don't do it for any gain. They're about to, you know, he knows he's old. And he's telling the story because if he doesn't tell it, no one's going to know it.
Right.
And I always pay special attention. There's a reason why deathbed confessions have a you know, legal significance in our laws, is because we know that there's just an odd lack of self-interest at that moment in time when you're really that old. It's because you want the truth out and you want people to know your story.
Clearly, I found this one fascinating, educational, revealing. What's on the docket to top the Nazi conspiracy?
Yeah, that's the question right now. So Josh and I are working on our next one, but what I should talk about that came out the same week as the Nazi conspiracy is our new kids book. So this is going to be my segue from Nazis to children, to children's books. But, you know, you and I talked about our books, the I Am series, the Ordinary People Change the World series. I Am Amelia Earhart, I Am Rosa Parks, I Am Dr. King, I Am Abraham Lincoln, and all those. And we're finally doing I Am John Lewis. And I Am John Lewis is just released. And what no one knew, I haven't been able to, I didn't ever talk about, is John Lewis was one of the biggest early supporters of the Ordinary People Change the World series. He really enjoyed our book on Rosa Parks. And when I was writing I Am Martin Luther King Jr., I asked him to be the advisor for the book because, of course, he marched with Dr. King. And he was the advisor for that book and helped us correct it and get all the facts correct. And my only regret is I never got to tell him we were doing a book for him. And it's a book about getting in good trouble. And when he was a boy, if you were young and you were black and a white person was walking at you on the street, you were expected to cross the street, go to the other side. But his grandmother wouldn't do that. His parents would say, you know, don't make trouble. But his grandmother would just politely, always respectfully say, I'm sorry that I'm going to be walking. Thank you and please and goodbye. And he saw that lesson. He saw the lessons of Dr. King and Rosa Parks. And he spent the rest of his life getting into good trouble. And always when they asked him how you can keep your calm when people are, you know, spitting at you and fighting you and cursing you, he said it was his faith. And his faith he defined as the ability to make, believing in something so deeply you make a way out of no way. And boy, do I love that, making a way out of no way. So I want my daughter to have that lesson. I want my sons to have that lesson. And I tell you that simply to say that the Nazi conspiracy and I Am John Lewis, one is an adult book, for a nonfiction book for adults, one is a nonfiction book for kids. But I don't think it's a coincidence they both deal with the same thing, which is using your voice when you see injustice and speaking up. And to me, it's just where I'm seeing the world right now and what we need more of.
There is a through line there. Brad Meltzer, thank you so much. He's a New York Times bestseller more than a dozen times over, author of the new book, The Nazi Conspiracy. Thank you for your charm offensive.
I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.
And The Nazi Conspiracy and I Am John Lewis both out now. An even longer version of our talk at ideastream.org. At noon today on WKSU, we bring you Governor DeWine's State of the State Address live from Columbus. Tomorrow in The Sound of Ideas, the Rock Hall rolls out this year's induction nominees. Kabir Bhatia and others join me to talk rock. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.